It was a month before Robin was allowed to pay her first visit to the castle. After the guard at the gates inspected her pass, she was led to a small whitewashed guardroom, devoid of all furniture except three high-backed, uncushioned chairs. She remained standing for 10 minutes before the low door opposite her was opened and Clinton stooped through it. He stopped facing her, and she was struck instantly by the prison pallor of his skin. His deep water tan had faded to a tobacco stain of yellow, and the roots of his hair, no longer bleached by salt and strong sunlight, had darkened. He looked older, tired and dejected. "You at least have not deserted me in my disgrace," he said simply. The subaltern of the guard took the third chair and tried to look as though he was not listening to their conversation. Robin and Clinton sat facing each other stiffly on the uncomfortable chairs, and their conversation was at first as stilted, a polite series of inquiries after each other's health. Then Robin asked, "Have you received the newspapers?" "Yes, the warder has been good to me." "Then you have read what the new American president has promised at his inauguration." "Lincoln was always a staunch enemy of the trade," Clinton nodded. "He has granted the ships of the Royal Navy the right of search at last." "And 6 of the southern states have seceded already," Clinton told her grimly. "There will be fighting if he tries to force it."
"It's so unfair," Robin cried. "Just a few short weeks and you would have been a hero instead of a..." She broke off with her hand to her mouth. "I'm sorry, Captain Codrington."
"Captain no longer," he said.
"I feel so much to blame. Had I not sent that letter..."
"You are so kind, so good," then he blurted abruptly, "and so beautiful that I can scarcely bear to look at you." Robin found herself blushing hotly, and she glanced at the listening guard officer. He was studying the rough plaster ceiling of the cell. "Do you know what I thought when I entered the chamber and saw the dirk pointed at me?" Clinton went on, and she shook her head. "I thought I was going to lose you, that they would hang me and I would never see you again." His voice was shaking with such emotion that the listening officer rose to his feet. "Dr. Ballantyne, I'll leave the room for 5 minutes," he said. "Do I have your word that you will not attempt to pass a weapon or a tool to the prisoner in my absence?" Robin nodded jerkily and whispered, "Thank you." The moment the door closed, Clinton launched himself across the gap between them and dropped to his knees before Robin. He encircled her waist with both arms and pressed his cheek to her bosom. "But now I have nothing to offer you. I have nothing to share with you but my disgrace." Robin found herself stroking his hair as though he were a child. "Soon I will go back to that beautiful land below the Zambezi River. I know now that that is where my destiny lies," she said quietly, "to minister to the souls and the bodies of those who live there." She paused a moment and looked down fondly on the dense, pale locks of his hair. "You say you have nothing to offer, nothing to share. But I have something to offer you and to share with you." He raised his head and looked up at her questioningly, hope starting to dawn in his pale sapphire eyes. "Will you not offer yourself to be ordained in God's service as a missionary, and come with me into the wilderness, to the land of the Zambezia?" "To share my life with you and with God?" His voice was husky and choked. "I never dreamed I was worthy of such an honour." "The fellow is a prig," said Zuga firmly. "And damn me, but now he's a jailbird to boot. Neither of you will be able to hold up your heads in society. He has a true and noble spirit, and now he has found his true calling in God's service," Robin replied hotly. "Neither of us intend spending much of our time in society. You may be certain of that." Zuga shrugged and smiled. "Of course, that is your affair. At least he has made a pretty packet of prize money, which they can't take away from him."
"I assure you that the money had nothing to do with my decision."
"I will believe that." Zuga's smile infuriated her. But before she could find a scathing enough retort, he turned away and sauntered the length of the long veranda under the trellised vines, and stood with his hands thrust into his pockets, staring out across the Cartwright's garden, to the far glimpses of blue bay seen through the oaks and the rustling palms. Robin's anger subsided and gave way to regret. It seemed now that the two of them must always be squabbling, their desires and their motives always directly opposed. At first her relief at his safety had been almost as strong as her sisterly delight at seeing him again. She had barely recognised him as he rode the bony, sway-backed mule up the path to the Cartwright mansion. It was only when he dismounted and lifted the stained old hat from his head that she screamed with joy, leapt up from the luncheon table, and ran down off the terrace to hug him. He was so lean and hard and bronzed, and somehow endowed with new authority, charged with purpose and presence, that she glowed with pride as he recounted his experiences, and all the company hung avidly on each word. "He is like a Greek god," a letter Cartwright had whispered to Robin, which was not an original description. But then a letter did not run much to original thought, and Robin had to agree that in this case it was accurate. She had followed his description of the land of the Matabele, and of the long trek southward with all her attention, asking such acute questions that Zuga had asked sharply, "I hope that you will not be using any of this in your own account, Sissy." "Of course not," she assured him. But still, that had been the first sour note. And he had not spoken further of his adventures, except to give her the greetings and news of their grandfather, Robert Moffat, at Kuruman. "You would never believe that he was 75 years old this past December. He is so bright and alive that he has just finished translating the Bible into the Sichuan language. He gave me every courtesy and help, and it was he who arranged for mules and for the cart which made the last portion of the journey so much easier. He remembered you as a little girl of 3 years old, and he has received your letters and gave me this in reply." It was a thick packet. "He tells me that you have asked him about leading a missionary expedition to Zambezia, or Matabele land." "That is correct." "Sissy, I do not think that a woman on her own," he had begun, but she had forestalled him. "I shall not be alone. Captain Clinton Codrington has decided to seek ordination as a missionary, and I have consented to become his wife." That had led to the explosion which had once more marred their relationship. As her anger faded, she made another determined effort to avert the new clash of temperament. "Zuga," she went down the length of the terrace and took his arm, "I would be grateful if you would consent to give me away at the wedding." Some of the hardness went out of his arm as his muscles relaxed. "When will that be, Sissy?" "Not for 7 months. Clinton has that much longer of his sentence, you see." Zuga shook his head. "I will not be here. I have booked passage on the P&O steamer that sails for home at the beginning of next month." They were both silent, and then Zuga went on. "But I wish you joy and happiness, and I apologize for the remark I made about your future husband." "I understand," she squeezed his arm. "He is a different kind of man from you." Zuga almost exclaimed, "Thank God for that," but caught the blasphemy before it reached his lips, and again they were silent. Zuga was considering the problem that had concerned him so intimately since his return to Cape Town, how to find out from Robin what she had written in her manuscript, and if possible to influence her into amending those portions of it which might offend the family reputation. Now that he had learned that she would not be returning to England, the natural opportunity had presented itself. "Sissy, if your manuscript is prepared, I'll be happy to take it with me, and to make certain that it is delivered safely to Oliver Wicks." The voyage to England would give Zuga ample opportunity to study Robin's work, and if the delivery was delayed for a month or so after his arrival, then Zuga's own published account of the expedition would skim the cream off the pool of interest and critical literary attention. "Oh! Did I not mention it to you?" Robin lifted her chin, and her smile was spiced with a little spiteful relish. "I sent my manuscript on the mail steamer a month before your arrival here. It'll be in London already, and I should not be surprised if Mr. Wicks has not published it already. I expect he will have sent the reviews, and we will have them on the next mail ship." Zuga jerked his arm out of her grip, and his eyes were steely as he glared down at her. "I really should have mentioned it," she added sweetly. His reaction confirmed her suspicions, and she knew that what last small chance they had was finished. From now on they would be enemies, and somehow she knew that the centre of their enmity would always be the land and peoples of that faraway country between two great rivers, which Zuga had named Zambezia. At the end of the Woodstock Road, on the bank of the Leaspiac River, not far from the domed roof of the Royal Astronomical Observatory, stands the Cartwright Warehouse. It is a rambling, whitewashed building of unburnt Kimberley brick with a corrugated iron roof. Against the rear wall of the main storeroom stood three articles left there in storage and for later collection by Major Maurice Zuga Ballantyne, presently on passage aboard the Peninsula and Orient steamship SS Bombay from India to the Pool of London. The three bulky articles were almost completely screened by the bays and hillocks of bales and crates and of barrels and bags, which reached almost to the high ceiling. The two huge elephant tusks formed a perfect frame with their curved yellow ivories for the third package. The carved soapstone figure was still contained in its protective covering of plaited elephant grass and twisted bark rope. It stood upright on its wide, heavy base, and it was merely chance that it faced towards the north. The grass covering had been torn away from the head by careless handling, and long months of travel on the shoulders of porters and on the buckboards of an unsprung Cape cart. The cruel, proud head of the bird of prey protruded from its wrappings. The stony, sightless eyes stared across forest and mountain and desert. 1,500 miles. To a walled and ruined city. And the words of the Umlimo's prophecy seemed to hover in the air above the graven head of the bird like living things. "The white eagle has stooped on the stone falcons and cast them to earth. Now the eagle shall lift them up again, and they will fly afar. There shall be no peace in the kingdoms of the Mambos or the Monemotapas until they return. For the white eagle will war with the black bull until the stone falcons return to roost."